I just knew when Roger called that anything he's up to, I want to be associated with. So it just raises my standing. That's the way I look at it. So it's a very selfish decision on my part. And now to meet you guys and to be with you, it's a real honor in this beautiful, beautiful setting. When I was in seminary, we had the apostolic commitment that we had to engage in, and so I did a few things during those years that was apostolic, but I remember one of them that really made me think about our engagement with the poor on a deeper level. I came to my vocation as a priest later in life, in my teens and in my early 20s. I was away from the church. And in the 70s, I was involved with a lot of activism in California. So a lot of the social activism stuff was very familiar to me. And I had a profound conversion through reading economics, oddly enough. But that's a whole other story. You can find God anywhere. And so I came back to the church and really reacclimated my life and retrieved the faith that I had been raised in but had abandoned for about 13 years, and kind of decompressed and was spiritually fumigated over about a 5-year period of time, then went into seminary and was shocked to find out when I got to seminary. I mean, remember, I left the church right about the time of the council and came back and said, "What happened?" Because I found all of this stuff that I had been involved with in left-wing politics right in the middle of the church. All of the activism now was being, I mean, it was the baptism of Karl Marx. Liberation theology was all the rage in seminary. Almost every single course I had a dimension in it. You know, whether it was ecclesiology or sacramentality or whatever, it had, and liberation theology's take on this. And so I was looking at all of this, and I said, boy, this is exactly what I left. And now here it is in a kind of religious rhetoric and a religious vocabulary. I was very fortunate in those years that Avery Dulles was teaching at CU, and I took every class of his that I could take, and he really... he's not the kind, I don't know if any of you know him, he's not the kind of person who tells you what to think, but he teaches you how to think, and he models how to think about things. And so a lot of that helped clear my mind, and I began doing rereading the economics I had read now through a theology, through Catholic social teaching. And when I was in seminary, and we were told, you know, you have to engage the poor, be with the poor. And so one of the things that I did was worked in Anacostia in a little, there was a, every week on Friday we would go to this basement of a Baptist church where this nun set out food, and it was a soup kitchen. And so we'd go, and our job was to kind of put out all the food and then serve the food and then clean it up. And I remember, you know, we were doing this, and one day I was taking out the trash, and there was a line of people, and these ladies jumped out of a cab and came up and said, "Can we get in the front of the line, because we really don't have a lot of time, and could we cut the line?" I'm just thinking to myself, they just jumped out of a cab. What are you doing? Well, we got to go shopping, and we, you know. And I thought, But the nun had told us, don't make any judgments of people when they come here. Whosoever will may come. So you just welcome everybody who comes. So, okay, so we welcome them, sure, you know, try to accommodate them. One Friday, I remember it was in Lent. My seminary classmate and I hadn't anything. Just sometimes we would sit down and eat, but this was... they were serving chili that day, I remember. And so we waited, and then we went to a fish and chips place after we served everybody and cleaned everything up. And I walked into the fish and chips place, and it was after the lunch hour, and there was a teenage girl sweeping out the place, and this man came up with sleeves rolled up and took our order, and he put it through the little window, and I could see in the kitchen there was a woman frying fish. And I looked around, and this heretical thought dawned on me. Where's this man's competition? We're operating a soup kitchen in his neighborhood. We don't have to pay taxes. We don't have to pay insurance. We don't even have to pay for the product, because all of that was donated by the nice ladies of different churches in Chevy Chase, Maryland. You know, this nun was very ingenious on how she got the food. She contacted the ladies' guilds of all the churches, Catholic, Protestant, whatever, and she'd give them a recipe. And like all these different ladies would make the same recipe, probably handed it to their maids and had their maids make the recipe, who handed it to the chauffeur who drove it down to the little Baptist church where we served it. But it dawned on me that this man was trying to support his family, and here we were running a soup kitchen in his neighborhood, basically competing with him, offering a meal on a Friday that was far more attractive for the people to come to because they didn't have to pay for it. And we weren't asking anything of the people who were coming to us. We didn't ask them for a contribution. We didn't ask them to help us to set out the food, to clean up the food, to help straighten up the tables. We didn't ask them to do anything. And as I began thinking about that, I began thinking, there's something wrong with this. And I kind of mulled that over and then put it through what I had learned about economics, and came to some conclusions that I thought, these are pretty radical, almost heretical conclusions. That you should respect the poor so much that you ask them to participate in their own amelioration to the extent that they can. That you don't just see people as passive victims. That is a form of disrespect. Now, I know that in this group, I don't have to rehearse all of the theological reasons that we have an obligation to the poor. But it's good to just remind ourselves, and this is what I think Benedict does in this encyclical so well, that the fundamental vocation of the Christian is love, but real love. Not a kind of superficial love, but a real love that gives not only meaning to human life, but points to the destiny of human life, which is ultimately the encounter with the eternal love. He says in the encyclical, in one place, that Christianity is not simply a proposition, but it is an encounter with love, with the person of love, who is love. And I remember struggling with that and very tentatively trying to articulate this and doing a very bad job of it once. I remember I had said, kind of told a story like this when I was in Australia once in public. And the story went that there were some young ladies who had come to the rectory and asked, they said, we want to go to Calcutta to serve the poor. And I just looked at these two beautiful co-eds, very nicely dressed. And I said, really, you're going to go to Calcutta? Yeah. I said, you know, the poor stink. And I took them down to a soup kitchen, and it was well, of course, you know exactly what happened. That was the headline the next day. Father Sirico says the poor stink. You know, completely ripped out of context. It took me the rest of the week in Australia to kind of contextualize what I had said. But the point being that we encounter Jesus Christ in human vulnerability. That's the point. And that the economic status is not the definition of poverty in the biblical sense of the word. That there is a certain anthropology that animates Christianity. This also is what Benedict does in this encyclical. And I'm going to just add a few things to what he says to augment the argument, give different examples than the ones that you find in the encyclical. But here's what I'd like you to think about. That the Christian anthropological vision sees the human person who presents him or herself to us as an immortal entity. And what serves as the reason for serving the poor, or the necessity for serving the poor in much of social service work today, much of philanthropic work today, is predicated on a materialist assumption. That is, we see the poor and they are hungry, so we get them food. They are thirsty, we get them to drink. They are without clothing, we clothe them. We house them. And that's kind of our engagement with the poor. But if you take that as the totality of what you're doing, then I suggest you're missing the most critical part of it. Because that, after all, is the way we treat animals. When they are hungry, when they are in the elements, we take them in the barn, we put water or hay in front of them, we put a blanket on them. That human beings are more complex than this. This is a point that was made by Daniel Lu, who was one of the fathers of the Second Vatican Council. He wrote in the 1960s an article that appeared in Lo Zortore Romano called Horizontalism, which was, if I might call it, a kind of precursor to Deus Caritas Est. And what he's warning there, it's a direct warning to Catholic social service agencies, to Catholic charities. Don't just relate to a person on a material level. Consider who the totality of the being is who is in front of you in need. Do not reduce Christian charity, he says in this article, to philanthropy. Philanthropy is fine in its own place, but Christian charity is what gives resonance to philanthropy. And the point that Benedict makes here is this was Julian the Apostate's engagement with the church. He saw the charitable work of the church and wanted to imitate it. Now, we have come to this point, I think, in history, at least in the United States, to a great extent, even internationally. I'm not going to name names here, but you fill in the blanks. To the point where we are afraid to preach what we practice, or the reason for what we're doing. We don't give a name to it. We don't assign the motivation, the inspiration. And you know, you can do that in an encounter or two. But when you begin to build a culture of that, where you're afraid to name the inspiration for what you're doing, I am here because of Jesus Christ. Don't say that in every pastoral encounter, of course not. But if you lose track of that and you build a culture and institutions and successive generations of people, you have this mechanism that exists without the heart of it anymore, and then pretty soon the mechanism begins to corrode and even serve purposes that are antithetical to the root inspiration. I think that's a lot of what is behind this encyclical. And I think what Benedict does here, you know, like you, I was really waiting for the first encyclical to say, I thought it was going to be the programmatic encyclical. I think that really came the morning after his election. I think that was the programmatic document, that homily he preached in the Sistine Chapel. But I think what he does here is, in a very subtle, nuanced, dense, and this is what's so great about Benedict, is he puts in few sleek words a lot of meaning into what he's saying. What he is doing here is reiterating and amplifying a lot of what he did with the documents, the two CDF documents on liberation theology, warning the church not to lose its sense of itself, its identity, its mission, and being reduced or seduced into activism. That what is very clear running through this entire encyclical is an anthropological vision that sees the human person, as I said, as an immortal being invested with this splendor beyond this world. C.S. Lewis, great Christian writer who, in my estimate, didn't live long enough to kind of bring everything to fruition for himself, said something that I think really makes the point eloquently. And I'm quoting him from memory. I'm sure what he wrote, the way he wrote it, is far more eloquent than I can recall from memory. He said, "You have never met a mere mortal. Everyone from whom you have ever purchased anything, anyone with whom you have ever fought, everyone you have ever loved and argued with, every shop girl from whom you have ever purchased something, is either an immortal horror or an everlasting splendor. But you have never met a mere mortal." And then he goes on to say that the most sacred thing that presents itself to our senses next to the Blessed Sacrament itself is our neighbor. That, I suggest, is at the root of Christian charity. When we lose that sense, we lose it all. Not only Julian the Apostate, but others in the early centuries of Christianity saw this this sense of charity that was part and parcel of the Christian identity, self-identity. There's a rescript that was written, I'm not really sure, I think it's probably the second century, I know that it was written from Antioch, and it is this Roman soldier who is writing back describing a plague that had broken out in Antioch, and he says that I've pulled back my men so that they're not infected with this. The politicians were the first to leave. The medical doctors have even left. The families of people who were infected have left. But there is a curious thing. There is a group of people who, not infected themselves, are remaining with the people who are dying, tending to their needs. And these are, and he's describing a group of early Christians. You know, it's interesting that this should have been observed in Antioch, because you remember that Antioch is the place where Christians are called Christians for the first time. So you see right there this vision of who the human person is, like the Blessed Sacrament itself. Well, it's the words of Jesus, right? You have tended to the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. And if you think of this, and this is a real bold claim, bold assertion, but I think it's true, I think it's borne out in history, that charity as an institutional function, I'm not talking about just almsgiving when people are in need or a few people doing a few things, but as an institutional and as an international reality, an international institution, emerges from the church. It emerges from the church both because of its anthropological vision, and it emerges from the church institutionally because of the church's universal, its Catholic vision, its international vision. And that's why you have systems of charity that come out of Christian inspiration. Moreover, inventions of such institutions like the hospital likewise come out of Christian inspiration and Christian experience. You remember that roughly in the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages, people who would be dying and their families didn't know what to do with them, they would take them to convents. And the nuns would take them in and put them in the back quarters of convents, the rooms that they had, extra rooms. These were the original hospices, places where people would die. Now, in the course of doing that, the nuns developed techniques of hygiene, of care, of primitive forms of medicine. That's where you get all these digestives, you know, these wonderful herbs, sambuca, I can go on. But so they begin these early forms of medicinal care, and what happens over time is you have the institution of the hospital emerge from the early hospices. Again, this combination of the church as institution and the church as a possessor of a certain anthropological vision. By the way, if you have not read this new book, The Victory of Reason, by Rodney Stark. He in this book, he's not really dealing with hospitals, but he's dealing with a lot of institutional things that emerge out of Christianity in general and Catholicism in particular. The Victory of Reason. It's probably 3 months ago it was first published. He is a historian, sociologist, historian kind of thing, or historian of religious sociology, something like that, at Baylor University, not a Catholic yet, but you read him and you see where he's going. Wonderful delineation of the church's self-concept and how the church builds globalization, how the church undermines slavery and misogyny because of its universal vision of the potential to evangelize people. You know, everybody could be baptized in Christianity. It wasn't an ethnically bound religion. So if everybody could be baptized, and everyone had an immortal soul, that meant a whole lot of things in terms of certain structures that existed in the pagan world. And what you begin to see emerge from the church, and also because of the church's institutional nature, institutions around its belief begin to emerge. And again, this is what Benedict is alluding to here. And what I want to do is just kind of go through just a few of the things that touch on the church's social teaching. You know, a number of years ago, in fact, when Roger and I knew each other when he was at the NAC, I came to know one of the saints that I've met in my life. He's not yet canonized, but I think he will be canonized probably in our lifetime. Francis Xavier Van Tuan. If you don't know who Van Tuan was, he has some beautiful books, including a set of reflections that he did for the papal retreat one year, I think it was the year 2000. He was appointed the Archbishop of Saigon just prior to the American pullout of Vietnam. So he shows up from his home city of Hue in the north, shows up in Saigon, the Americans pull out, the Vietnamese communists take over, and they say, "Who are you? What are you doing here? Go back to your city." And he said, "No, I don't. I'm the bishop now of Saigon." "No, no, no, there's a bishop here. You go back to your city." And he said, "Well, I can't." He said, "If you don't go back, you're going to jail." They put him in jail for 13 years, 9 of those 13 years in solitary confinement. And I met him about a year after he was released from prison, when he was exiled to Rome. And he was the chaplain of some convent. And I got to know him, and eventually he was appointed to the Pontifical Council of Justice and Peace, for Justice and Peace, and was eventually made the president of that council, and then made a cardinal in the year 2000 by John Paul II. I remember when I sat with him and his staff, they asked, "What do you see as the biggest challenge to Catholic social teaching that we are facing right now?" And I said, "I think the biggest challenge is that in the minds, with regard to seminarians," he was talking, because a lot of our work is with seminarians. I said, "I think the biggest challenge is what I would call the hijacking of Catholic social teaching by the liberation theology folks, or those in a lot of the social justice, quote unquote, establishment. Because what they have read Catholic social teaching through a kind of ideological lens, and it seemed to me that this needs to be broken up." And I worked with him on the early drafts of what then eventually became the Compendium of Catholic Social Thought. Somewhat different book than the one I was working on earlier, but nonetheless really representative of a real change. I mean, if you read that book in conjunction with a lot of the stuff, particularly that came out of bishops' conferences, particularly the Latin American Bishops' Conference, and in the early 80s, the American Bishops' Conference, you read that book in tandem with that, you're going to find a very mature vision of Catholic. I'm not a diplomat. A mature vision of Catholic social teaching compared to it. And some of the elements are what I think Benedict is going through in this encyclical, speaking about the gradual development of the church's social teaching. Love, Benedict says in Deus Caritas Est, is no mere whim or sentiment. This is, you know, if you need a good stock wedding homily, this is the stock wedding homily, is to really talk about what love is, rather than the sentiment and the romance and I'm attracted to you and I'm blind in love with you. He hits all of these things. And to talk about love as a challenging vocation and an act of the will and the very raison d'etre of our existence, which is what he is emphasizing. In the first part of this work, he outlines this holistic vision of love. And I think it's very curious that a lot of the social service agencies, a lot of the Catholic charity agencies, remained relatively silent on the promulgation of this encyclical. I'm certainly not aware of a lot of fanfare, a lot of press releases, a lot of beating of the drums when this encyclical came out. And you think this would be their Magna Carta. Now, why would that be? I think because what Benedict does in this encyclical is he basically removes political activism as the essential mode by which Catholic charity is expressed. He says explicitly in this encyclical that justice is the work of politics and the state, and that charity is the work of the church, and that there is an overlap, but we can't get these two things confused, because if we do, we sacralize the state, which is the exact opposite of what Christianity did in its first centuries, and then we politicize the church, and then that further divides the church and causes it to lose its vision of itself, its self-identity. To the surprise of many people, after sorting through all the linguistic challenges associated with love, he does not reject the Greek notion of eros. Rather, he situates eros in a broader context. Eros is not destroyed by Christianity, he argues, but it is elevated by it. And unlike the Greeks, Christianity sees eros as not something to be settled for as an intoxicating degradation of human sensibility and dignity, but what he says is that it is to be transformed into, quote, a certain foretaste of the pinnacle of our existence, of that beatitude toward which our whole being yearns. Far from rejecting or poisoning eros, Benedict says, Christianity seeks to restore its true grandeur. So this is the anthropological vision that animates Deus Caritas Est, and it is situated in a view of the human person as both and simultaneously corporeal and transcendent. So that the human person, in practical terms, this means for the human person that love must be concrete and enfleshed. There's no greater demonstration of this enfleshment, of course, than the Incarnation. The Incarnation becomes the model by which we see everything in Christianity. The Word of the Father, who was in the beginning with God and was God, also became man and dwelt among us. Probably more than any other doctrine of the Church is the doctrine of the Incarnation that is the cause for the Church becoming an institutional religion. It could just be an ethnic, it could have just been an ethnic religion. It could have just been a religion of belief, but it becomes a religion of institution, and one that concerns hierarchy, one that concerns culture, one that is interested in history and the like. Chesterton, you may remember, quipped that Catholicism is the religion of stuff. All this stuff that goes into making it, this serves history very well, as Stark breaks out. This is also, by the way, the danger for the detractors, the dissenters, who see the notion of hierarchy and institution as somehow crushing the kind of more blithe and free-spirited nature of authentic Christianity. This is the Gnostic impulse. This is the Da Vinci Code. This is the and I'm not pandering to anybody here tonight. I can pander. This is the Gospel of Judas. I mean, if you've read some of the Gospel of Judas, I haven't read the Gospel of Judas, but I've read the quotes, and instantly you see, you know, destroy this body which is hiding my true me, you know, these kinds of notions of the physicality. And nobody, isn't it interesting how nobody mentions that the feminist gospel of Mary Magdalene ends with Mary becoming an apostle only because she's transformed into a man? You know, where's the feminism of that? Well, rather than the Mother of God in historic Christianity. But anyway, this down-to-earth quality of the Christian church is what causes the church to engage on an institutional level and become the longest ongoing institution in human history. In addition to a hospital, think about the university, think about juridical institutions such as private property, the right to contract, global trade, institutional and globalized charity, as I mentioned. All of this comes out of the church's reverence for the individual human person created in the imago Dei and called to a finality beyond society and beyond this world itself. Now, the two principal pillars of Catholic social teaching, and I probably don't have to say this, but let me just kind of throw it out just so that we're all on the same page. Catholic social teaching, also sometimes called Catholic social doctrine, a lot of people get confused. You know, it's really amazing with a lot of the institutions of the church that if you dissent from the church's teaching on humanae vitae, on sexuality, you're kind of given a pass, you know, well, you got to be passionately sensitive to people, women's ordination, you know, we got to be inclusive and all that kind of stuff. You dissent on the minimum wage, and it's like you're a full-scale modern Aryan, you know? I mean, it's amazing. You know, this is an amazing juxtaposition because the Catholic Church has no official dogmatic stand on the minimum wage. I remember I was having a discussion with a superior once, and he was saying, but you've gotten into an argument with Monsignor Higgins on the minimum wage. He said, and you're dissenting from the church's teaching. I said, oh, I didn't know. What does the magisterium say that the minimum wage should be? What does it say? I mean, the notion of, and this is, by the way, I think one of the defects in the compendium. There's no one clear definition of what Catholic social teaching is, or its provisional nature. Benedict is clear on this, which is why he is trying to qualify and make distinct the political dimension, and whatever political obligations lay people may have, make that distinct from the church's core teachings. The church's social teaching is a set of propositions and prudential judgments that are rooted in an unalterable anthropological vision, the dignity of the human person from the moment of conception until natural death. Now, how you go about building institutions is a prudential thing. That's why Blessed John the 23rd, could say in Moderate Magistra that on these prudential things, Catholics can have a variety of points of view. You can have people who favor a lot of state intervention in a variety of things, and they can be authentic Catholics. You can have Catholics who want to restrict that considerably. The two principles of Catholic social thought that are immovable and non-negotiable, the principles of subsidiarity and solidarity. Solidarity, obviously, is when you recognize yourself in the other. It's when you recognize yourself in particular in the vulnerability of the other. And subsidiarity is the way in which you implement solidarity. These are not two principles of Catholic social thought that kind of what do I want to say, exclude each other. They are the way in which you live the two principles. Subsidiarity, it's really important. In the, I think it's the 38th paragraph of Centesimus Annus, and Benedict alludes to subsidiarity several times, again, in these very subtle ways. He says, the state must do X, Y, and Z according to the principle of subsidiarity. You go back to the definition of what subsidiarity is, and it simply says that communities of a higher order, a social organization, should not intervene directly into the affairs of communities of lower forms of social organization without grave necessity. And then what else John Paul II says is that when there is grave necessity, the intervention should just be as much as is needed and only until such time as the normative structures of society, the business economy and the like, can come and reassert themselves so that needs are best met. The way I kind of say it in a bumper sticker, this is my left-wing pedigree coming out, speaking in bumper sticker talk, you know, that needs are best met at their most local level of existence. That when a need exists, that you have the first obligation to meet your own need. You're hungry, you're thirsty, you meet that need. Okay, so you're having a bad day, you're in bed, your wife, your husband, your kids, your mom, your dad, somebody else gets you some food to eat. You can't work for a week, your family helps you. The more profound dysfunction, then you need extended family. Maybe you need some support from them. Maybe you need neighbors to help. Maybe you need some charitable institutions to come in. Maybe you have a whole family that is out of whack. And so you go up the ladder, but the moment you, and you do it in such a way that you try and enable this person to take care of his needs, or you enable a family to take care of their own needs, but you don't immediately substitute for those lower, more proximate institutions or people or relationships, an immediate intervention from a centralized state. That's what the principle of subsidiarity is saying. The very word subsidiarity comes from the root subsidium, which, as I recall, was the kind of supply lines, the rations that were given to Roman soldiers that were not to be used normally. But if the supply lines were interrupted and there was no flow of their supplies, then you would open up the subsidium and you had that to keep you until the reinforcements came. If you ate your subsidium when you didn't need to, then you'd really be in trouble when you need it. That's where it comes from. That whole passage, I think it's about 38-39 in Centesimus Annus, is a brilliant elaboration. I love the way Benedict works this in so much. There is such wisdom in abiding by the... And by the way, the principle of subsidiarity and how to apply the principle of subsidiarity depends upon the virtue of prudence. So it's not a fixed thing. You don't do this here and never do this. It's not an ideological position. It says, what can best help? And this is where you'd have a vibrant discussion among Catholic faithful, saying, I think we need higher taxes. I think we need more regulation. Or I think we need lower taxes. No. But to preserve the goal, which is the dignity, protecting the dignity of the person who is in need. There is a thing in economics that is called the synoptic fallacy. And it has nothing to do with the synoptic gospels, but it's taken from the same word. Synoptic gospels are the one-eyed, one-way, one-vision. The synoptic fallacy is the fallacy that society is best organized by a central clearinghouse, a central committee by which or in which you can see all of the needs of society and then orchestrate the resources to match the needs. This kind of synoptic view, one-eyed view of society. It doesn't exist. It's a fallacy. There is no one vision. Nobody knows what needs are, because needs are very often, more often than not, very subjective. A person makes a certain set of choices based on what they know about their own life. So to have some bureaucrats or political leaders that are relatively removed from the actual need that exists and make the decision is where you get the kind of famous dislocations that you had during the communist era, where you had rows and rows and rows of size 13 shoes and other people going barefoot, or the phenomenon of the communist line, where people would wait on long lines. Why? Because they didn't have a rationing system. They didn't have a price mechanism whereby relative needs were met with supply. So, you know, it really basically distorted the whole supply and demand equilibrium that would take place in a more market-oriented economy. So that the central planning sounds like, I had a man the other day say to me, I give a talk at Notre Dame, and in the question period he said, well, but if we had... what was it I was talking about? And he said, if you had that, if you didn't have the state doing that, you'd have, some people wouldn't have anything. And I said, well, what if we had lived all of our lives in a society where the state provided shoes for us? And some radical came along and said, you know what, let's allow shoe production to be privately operated. Wouldn't it be the first thought, everybody'd say, well, there's going to be rich people are going to have shoes and poor people aren't going to have any. But that's not what happens in a free society. Some people wear secondhand shoes. Some people wear very, very fancy shoes, which really take quite acrobatic skill sometimes to balance oneself on those, not to mention the orthopedic bills that come later from backs being out of whack. But generally what you have is society has access to the kinds of shoes that they want. Same thing with food production. For the most part, food production is private. And because of that has much more flexibility in terms of getting needs met. It's not perfect, but it coordinates. Now, let me say a few things about the intersection between politics and religion, which is always a dangerous topic, although I've already kind of alluded to it. I'm sorry. What's religion got to do with politics? Well, Benedict says in this encyclical that obviously the core root of the state's motivation for justice is ethical. And that's the point at which there is a kind of commonality of concern. But according to this encyclical, religion can have too big an impact insofar as government seeks to enact an agenda that belongs to the realm of personal ethics. You know what? I think I have a hunch that what Benedict is doing here is reminding people, probably a lot of the editorialists at the New York Times, that Christianity holds to a distinction between God and Caesar. That we are not baptized members of the Taliban. The notion of some people is that when Christianity wants to influence the public sphere, that it's the same kind of totalist, monist approach to religion and politics as you find in the Quran, as you find in the jihadists and in the Islamicists. And that what Christianity does and what Islam so sadly needs, George Weigel, I think, said in an essay that Islam awaits its Augustine. It awaits someone to write from within the world of the Quran and the mentality of Islam a city of God and city of man kind of work, that you can make these distinctions. But right at the beginning of Christianity, you have God and Caesar. A legitimate autonomy of the state, even a secular autonomy. You know, when this encyclical came out, I read it early in the morning. I didn't see any advanced copies of it, so I pounced on it. The minute it came out, I remember I was up at like 5:30 in the morning online reading the encyclical, which worked out well because then I immediately got a call when I got in to the office from, of all places, The Economist magazine. How they found me to ask me to comment on this. But it was very interesting. He said, oh, this is very interesting. And he actually wrote a much better article than he sounded on the phone. I just cringed when I talked to him, but the article seemed was rather good. And he said, well, you're saying then, are you, that you're saying that this compassionate conservatism, that that Benedict has written a compassionate he's gotten this compassionate conservatism stuff. I said, no. What I'm saying, if anything, the compassionate conservatives have got this from the church. The church didn't get it from them. That we kind of have been in this business for a while. This extended and deeply inspiring reflection on what Christianity contributes to the idea of love in all of its respects, why love can only achieve its perfection within the context of faith, and why we all need to purify the idea of the way it's become understood in the modern context. These are all kind of the things that are in this encyclical. This unavoidable obligation that he speaks of, I want to quote from the encyclical, and I didn't write the number down, but you can find it in here. Love of neighbor, grounded in the love of God, is first and foremost a responsibility for each individual member of the church, of the faithful. But it is also a responsibility for the entire ecclesial community at every level, from the local community to the particular church, and to the church universal in its entirety. The subject inevitably comes up in the secular religious debates of the day, whether and to what extent the public sector needs to be informed by the Christian charitable obligation. I've already alluded to some of that. Does the carrying out the need for the love and charity that is Christianity's inspiration require Christians to work for building up the political systems that punish the rich and shore up the status of the poor? You just think of the conventional wisdom on this. I mean, the whole argument after Katrina was what the federal government did or didn't do, what the state government did or didn't do. Bottom line is, the vast majority of people caught in that whole thing were treated with the greatest respect and were effectively helped, were done so by Christian institutions who were local to the situation. But really, it's the big untold news story of what actually happened in Katrina. And this has happened time and time again. I remember when Andrew, how many years ago was Andrew? It hit Florida, 98. The Mormons, you know, for all of their theological absurdity, have a great social system in place. What I don't know if you know what Mormons are. There's no Mormon in good standing with the Mormon church who's on welfare. None. They all have this system where they have what they call a bishop's warehouse. It's like a grocery store. And everybody in the local church, the local stake they call it, works to contribute to this. And then if your family has some need, they send you shopping there. There's a story of a Mormon farmer who fell off his tractor and busted himself up something fierce. He was in the hospital, in traction. He could just move one hand. The Mormon elders came to the thing, and they said, well, what do you need? And, you know, and they verified that this was his income, and this is, you know, and they've got to pay for the farm. The harvest has to be taken in. They organized people to bring in the harvest. They sent the wife shopping in the store to get what she needed. They paid some of the rent, and they brought him to his hospital bed piecemeal work that he could do while he was in the hospital, so at least he was still contributing to the support of his family. And when Andrew hit, what the Mormons did, I saw a map of this, they had all these tractor trailers that they have in all kinds of locations throughout the country, a different Mormon, the equivalent of their diocese. They just moved them to the edge of the storm, waited for the storm to go through, and then moved in. And in each of these big trailers, there was supplies for 500 people, including tents, water, blankets, food, clothes, the works. And they just moved in with that long before FEMA could begin to move in. These kinds of charitable, direct charitable things. Think of the myriad of political concerns that consume so many of our friends. Brothers and sisters, you know, from tomato pickers in Florida and universal health care and the alleged widening gap between rich and poor and everything. Even down to the faith-based initiatives that this administration's put forward. I mean, which is basically how to get money from the government. That's basically what the faith-based initiatives are. And I think we may rue the day when our charities become excessively dependent upon this kind of thing. Benedict takes issue with the idea that has been around for more than 100 years. And he says that the problem begins with Marxism and Marxism's argument against charity. You know, if you read the encyclical, you know that Marx thought charity basically anesthetized the poor. That what you want to do is let the poor really get in touch with the misery of their poverty, and then they'll overthrow the ruling class. And Benedict is pushing all of that aside. Charity, in this view, only soothes the consciences of the exploiting class. Marxism sought world revolution and collectivization as the means to help the poor. In one eloquent line, the Pope says that the Marxist illusion has vanished. I just pictured Benedict doing that with his hand, pushing it off the table. So now we're dealing with the reality of globalized marketplace in which we have to be effective evangelists. How crazy is it if we, through our institutions of charity, inspired by the Christian anthropology, now become secularized, closing off the sphere of evangelization. I'm not talking about proselytization. I'm just talking about the occasion to share with people the reason we believe what we believe. You know, in closing, I want to offer an alternate view from the popular view of class struggle. Marx came up with a very intriguing and seductive and resilient taxonomy when he put forth the kind of inverted Hegelian notion, this class struggle, that there was an intrinsic hostility between the worker and the owner of the means of production. And then feminism takes it another step and says there's this intrinsic hostility between women and men. And radical environmentalism says there's this intrinsic hostility between man and the creation. And the whole indigenous movement, you know, and you just go and you see how it replicates itself. It's fascinating. What if, rather than economic class struggle, we had a vision of economic harmonies? And I'll quote an authority on this, who knew next to nothing, as far as I could tell, about economics proper, demonstrates no particular interest in politics proper, but who nonetheless offers an alternative and equally compelling vision. And this is Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta. She said, "We have no right to judge the rich. For our part, what we desire is not class struggle, but class encounter, where the rich save the poor, and the poor save the rich." What a lived vision of solidarity that would be. But what that requires is a reading and understanding of an encyclical like this, a catechesis around it that understands what love is, what church social teaching actually is, and the provisional nature. The Pope warns the state, this is in number 28, the state which would provide everything, absorbing everything into itself, would ultimately become a mere bureaucracy incapable of guaranteeing the very thing which the suffering person, every person, needs, namely loving personal concern. We do not need a state which regulates and controls everything, but a state which, in accordance with the principle of subsidiarity, generously acknowledges and supports initiatives arising from the different social forces and combines spontaneity with a closeness for those in need. You know, there's an editorial in the Wall Street Journal a number of years ago. It was called 9,999 Points of Light. And it was the story, true story, of Mother Teresa wanting to open a home for the dying indigent in New York. Somebody had donated one of these brownstones. I think it was like a six-floor brownstone. And the New York Commission of the Handicapped said to Mother Teresa, if you're going to do this, you have to put an elevator in. If you're going to renovate this building, you have to put an elevator in. She said, no, we don't need an elevator. Our sisters wouldn't use the elevator. We want to live very simply. And they said, well, you have to, because, you know, you got six floors. What are you going to do with these people? Oh, they're dying. They're not going to be walking up and down the stairs. They said, well, what if somebody has to walk up the stairs or down the stairs? Oh, well, if that's happened, our sisters will carry them. And the New York Commission said, that would be an indignity. Telling Mother Teresa she's treating people like that. So Mother Teresa turned around and said, oh, well, then I guess God doesn't want us to open this. Never open the house. That's why 9,999 points of light, less one. The vision of personal engagement without the kind of onerous and politicized and bureaucratized approaches is precisely what's the heart of this. And two things result from that. If we promote this vision, if we live this vision in our institutions, if we are preaching these kinds of visions in our pulpits, two things result from that. The first is that the poor then are authentic human beings with whom we are dealing and from whom we receive a rich source of our own spiritual nourishment. We're encountering Christ in them. And the second, as I've already alluded, is the occasion for the presentation, the proposal of the gospel of Jesus Christ to those who have need of his message of love. I'll stop there and open it up for discussion. Thank you.
You will raise multiple questions, but just concentrate on one. If you find any sign in the bishops and they're dealing with immigration, they view immigrants as moral persons who have an obligation to follow the law, to tell the truth, etc. It's amazing to me that I never see any admonition to immigrants that they have to do such things.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between what the bishops' conference says on paper and what some of our prelates say in front of large crowds and the news media. And I think they are far less nuanced than the actual statements. No, I think that's absolutely correct. The churches, the Acton Institute has a very interesting, and we're kind of looking at it. We published it a few years ago, but I think it's called, it's gone out of my head, but it's on immigration. And we decided that it was too sophisticated for this debate, you know, that we're going to try and kind of break it down a little bit. The church, when it speaks about immigration, always says in its official documents, in the compendium, in the catechism, in any of the statements that come out of Rome, always bring in this point that nations have the right to govern their borders. Whether they say that immigrants have the obligation to obey those things, I don't know. But it also, I mean, the church has a generally positive view of immigration. What complicates the immigration debate, I think, isn't the immigration as such, but the conditions under which, people can come and the things that draw people. It's a lot different now. What's drawing people here now is a lot different than when my ancestors 100 years ago came from southern Italy to New York. a lot different. My grandfather came with $50, and that was it, and then had 13 children in the United States, and now, just in this generation, our generation, have we really begun to see that take effect. I think the other part of the question, if I were going to add some things to the debate that I'd like to see debated, would be what you say. What about the obligation of people to come to obey the laws of the land that they're coming to? Just laws. Also, what about the conditions in the country from which they are coming? In particular, Mexico, because that's much of what we're talking about here, the obligation for Mexico to build a prosperous economy so that people are less dire and less in need of moving in desperation. And then also the kinds of disincentives to people to work in the United States once they are here. By which I mean the kind of things that drive people underground in the economy, the excessive regulation, the immediate obligation to pay people Social Security, which is immediately says, I can't afford to give you insurance, give you Social Security, pay you above a minimum wage, and then do what for me? To clean my house? To garden? You know, and that's why you have a lot of people working in the informal economy, where they become so much more vulnerable. So you have to have some kind of system that loosens up some of this stuff. So there would be some of my off-the-top-of-my-head thoughts on that. Father?
Are you making a good point about, you know, the way Catholic charity normally looks, maybe just not simply philanthropy? Just for a concrete example, what would...
Well, I wouldn't have one image of it, because that would be the synoptic fallacy. I could see a variety of things. I mean, if you've ever been to one of Mother Teresa's, when I go to Rome, I don't give money on the street. You know, you'd have to be bleeding for me to, you know, and even then I would check to see if it's real blood. You know, I mean, these gypsies are ingenious.
Yes.
You go and talk to those nuns, who you know the little, what is it?
Domus Maria,
right on the wall of the Vatican. Those nuns will tell you, don't give these people anything. Send them here. So when I go, I drop off money there. And then I say, I'm sorry, go see Mother Teresa. She's got my money. You know. And they're duro. You know, I mean, they run an orderly place. They, you know, that would be one way to do it. I could see another way of doing it, because people are different. You know, they have different needs. I could see running a soup kitchen where you had the poor running the soup kitchen. You had some people coordinating it. I really love that idea of that nun who went to all of the ladies' groups and got all of the food that way. It's very innovative. But what I didn't like was that she never engaged the people. She just kind of was too much trouble to engage the people. I would ask people, you know, there's a wonderful quotation from the Didache, I think it's the Didache, that says, let me see if I can remember it. It says, when someone comes to you in the name of the Lord who's in need, test them and you will know them. If they are a foreigner, give them some work and give them something to eat. If they're going to settle among you, help them to get a craft to support themselves. If they refuse to do this, beware of such men. They are trading on the name of Christ. So you have this real kind of, even Paul, if a man doesn't work, neither let him eat. So I think what we need is some real backbone in our Catholic charity, not out of cruelty. And this is so easily portrayed as being calloused and not caring for the poor. What I'm saying is that we do care for the poor, and we care not just for the poor in their particular need, but we care for the character of the poor. And a lot of this has just changed in the last 100 years. I have a book from the 19th century, it was written in England, called Thrift. It's a wonderful book teaching thrift, teaching habits of virtue to people who are in need. And it's really with the advent of the modern welfare state that a lot of this stuff has kind of gone by the boards. And especially what concerns me is what has ended up happening to a lot of religious charities. This is why I'm very nervous about the faith-based initiatives. Rather than making money available, here's my concrete solution to let 1,000 flowers bloom. Rather than giving subsidy to Catholic charities, why don't you give a business, a tax credit, or an individual, a tax credit, not a tax deduction, a tax credit. Let's say my tax liability for this year is $10,000. And let's say, I'm just rounding off numbers, these are not even accurate in any proportion, but let's say $5,000 of that is dedicated to various kinds of social service agencies. Let's say half of that money, again, $2,500, I was allowed to donate directly to charities that I thought were doing good work. I'm not talking about the ballet. I'm talking about agencies that serve directly the poor in one way or another. So now I have $2,500 that I can give to an agency, I get a receipt for, and I don't have to pay that money to the government. I get a tax credit against my tax liability. What if I did that? What would happen in the world of philanthropy if people who are engaged in serving the poor had from each of us potential contribution? And I would say, if you don't give that money to some agency, then you give it back to the state. Okay, let them. What if you did the same thing with a business or professionals? Let's say you gave a doctor or a dentist a tax credit or a pro bono tax credit, so that a doctor in serving a poor family could deduct the amount that he would normally be paid from his or her tax liability. This would mean that the poor person wouldn't have to go to a welfare office or hospital to get served. They could go into whatever doctor's office and be served, and up to a certain amount. I mean, you do this kind of with pro bono lawyers kind of things. Why not do it with a whole host of services that could be provided, rather than the kind of complex system that you have now? What you'd end up doing is you'd go right around the bureaucracy, serve the people directly, engage the people directly.
That's the problem. Politicians will not be in control.
Right. You're absolutely right. That's the problem.
Holy Father talks about the duty-bound situation that the church must continue,
right,
and ethical formulation.
Right.
And he doesn't, I understand this is encyclical, he's not going to get into practicalities, but then he does talk about faith, which enables reason,
right,
to act more effectively. I guess the question I am asking is, what are some of those initiatives that you see the church might begin to more formally engage in?
You're talking now about the charitable function or the purification of the reason?
Purification of reason. Hmm. Through ethical formation.
Yeah, well, if I'm understanding correctly, what we need is a wholesale, bold transformation of our catechetical programs. We really need to get to this. I mean, it's enough with the montages, It's enough with the macrame and all the rest of it. We need to talk about these things in simple language that people understand. So you don't have to use big words, but you have to... And you know what I found in my pastoral ministry, when you say these things honestly and directly to people, they're appreciative. Sometimes people object, but I think we need... And I think it's happening. It's going to happen. I mean, the encouraging thing is... I said this the first time when I met Roger, and then the whole cluster of guys who were around Roger and Roger's age, some of you similar age, or Chris, and guys like this. These guys came in to seminary at the lowest ebb, And you know as well as I do, this is the wave of the future. The poor people in seminaries who are from the generation I was talking about earlier, are just going crazy. I mean, and they discovered gold chalices. Wow, isn't that innovative? All this kind of stuff. I think the next 15 years is, and especially with this kind of stuff, because these guys are going to take this and put it into use. They're going to use it for homilies. They're going to, people say, oh, I just really liked your homily. I said, I ripped it off from the Pope. I plagiarized the whole thing. If you kind of get into it and you think about it, it kind of pops out. You don't even know who really wrote it anymore, that kind of thing. That's exactly what needs to happen. That's our function. We're not all scholars, original scholars doing work. We're doing catechesis and stuff. And then out of that, the institutions will build. I mean, You know, this is where we really have it over a lot of... I have lots of evangelical friends. I mean, I was able to arrange for Jim Dobson, Focus on the Family, and Chuck Colson to meet the Pope. You know, and it was really funny because Dobson's a big, tall man and very, very fundamentalist, if you haven't noticed. And we showed him the Scavi and, you know, did this whole thing. And then he went to meet the Pope. And, of course, John Paul was weaker and he was seated. And Jim, who is a big, tall man... You can't use any of this. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Jim had to kneel down to talk with the Pope. So it was really, really, really funny. But the thing we have at Above Them is we have 2,000 years of experience and thinking on these things. We built the culture. Okay, we have to build it again. And the way we build it again is going back to the sources, understanding what we're about, understanding the reason for our existence, getting in love with Jesus Christ again, and then let those institutions emerge. It's not going to be quick. It wasn't quick the first time. But it will happen. It will emerge, and with these kinds of guys now who have not come in for status, you know, if they could have found something else to do with their lives, if they were looking for status, they're doing it because they fell in love with Jesus Christ and the church. And I just think the next 15, 20 years is going to be wonderful when these guys are being made bishops and the heads of seminaries and probably what they do. I think George Weigel has a point of it in the book on
Courage
to be Catholic. The Vatican probably needs to jump down a generation and start appointing guys a generation younger.
Maybe a more mundane or practical question, but as a pastor, I noticed that like when Katrina hit, my people were extremely generous. They raised like almost an equivalent of a month's collection. But
broke your heart to see it go.
Well, what broke my heart was they brought Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah.
Whenever these things like it's like the second collection the bishops take up.
Right.
They'll send money to Africa and South America, but then they'll take from what they would give to their parish. And I think a lot of pastors now get hesitant because they know they have a responsibility to keep the place going, pay the bills, and then you're trying to tell the people, you know, you have to do both. But I think in the like aftermath of the scandals now, a lot of people find whatever goes to anything related to the church, they think is paying off lawyers, and if it's something that's tangible to the poor, they have no problem with it. Mm-hmm. But if it's the bishop's appeal or if it's just the collection, you're saying we're just paying our electric bill. Is this going to be something that's going to be increasingly more difficult?
Well, I don't want to make light of this, but you know, there are consequences to the catastrophic idiocy on the part of the episcopacy. I mean, you know, they did it, and we got to clean it up, you know. And the thing I think that's the strongest counterbalance to that is our relationship with our people, and that they understand that you're vouching for something. And when I see a collection, a second collection that I have to take up that I am not enthusiastic about, I don't get enthusiastic about it. So there would be a second collection for blah, blah, blah.
Campaign
for people. You know, on the other hand, if there is a Katrina thing, I mean, we had our people out there, and not just the money, but the stuff people brought, the stuff. I think that's part of what we've got to go through, and I think that's part of the purification. And, you know, the thing we need to do is just be honest and non-defensive about it. Because, I mean, they're right. I mean, I'm not going to say any more about the bishop's conference. I'll never be a bishop. Where is my red hat? Yeah, no, I mean, this is something that has to be paid for. I'm not talking about money now. And it's something we're going to have to go through, and they're going to see our authenticity. And we'll get through it. I mean, look what we began with in catacombs. So And the minute the lights go off, they'll, you know, they'll fork it over. Now, don't do what I had a religious superior, and he was a real liberal. You know, he'd always and he took up a collection. I think it was the Andrew thing, or no, it was some flood in the Midwest somewhere. And we had called a parish in the middle of the flood, so we had the name of this little Mexican parish or Hispanic parish, you know, that needed this money there, you know. So we told the story, and the second collections were like double what the first collection was. And he wanted to switch the collections. I said, "You are not." I said, "I will write articles about this." No, I'm just joking. How much more time do I have?
There's time for another question.
One more question.
We'll take a 5-minute break before Father Romanus.
With the purification of reason, I wonder if we already see that unfolding, like in the state of Connecticut, where you have the question of marriage and health care and abortion and all these things. Our diocese has a lobbyist in the state legislature, and they're constantly working and they're constantly battling. So I think you're seeing the unfolding of that. Mm-hmm. It might not be coming to the reign of Christ the King, but nonetheless, there's the assertion of that through the church.
We just have to have the guts to risk it. You know, we have to have the guts. You know, I really admired O'Connor. Cardinal O'Connor had a showdown early on, years ago, with the state of New York over, as I recall, it was the foster care system. They wanted all the children to have either education or access to contraception. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Catholic Church in New York ran like 2/3 of all of the foster care placements in New York City. Something like that. I might have my numbers off. But it was an enormous amount of... And he just said, it's not going to happen. He said, and if you make this happen, then we'll give it all back to you, and you do it. And they back right down. I think a real mistake years ago was when... Can I be this direct? I mean, names... Sure. Was when Leveda backed down with Catholic Charities in San Francisco. You know, do you remember what happened? They were demanding partner benefits for homosexuals in San Francisco, and Willie Brown, who was the mayor of San Francisco at the time, said to Catholic Charities and to the Salvation Army, you are not religious organizations. When we give you the money, you are acting on behalf of the city of San Francisco, and you will do this, or we won't give you the money. The Catholic Charities got some Jesuit to come up with some reasoning for how they could, you know, do this. It was just barely acceptable. Salvation Army said, oh, okay, we won't do it. They lost $5 million. They probably raised $15 million off of the loss of the $5 million on that. But I think we have to risk some of these institutions. Our Catholic hospitals have become so in bed with the state and so dependent upon government money. 66% of Catholic Charities USA funding comes from the federal government. That's $1 billion a year. And this statistic is 12 years old. It might have gone up. So, he who drinks the king's wine sings the king's song. And it's of no comfort to me that the king right now is George Bush, because the next king or queen or princess no, I was not. I was referring to Hillary. I was referring to Hillary. Could be Hillary. And then what happens when, you know, then we have to face losing 2/3 of our funding for an organization? At the very least, say we cap it at 10%. I could take a 10% blow to my budget and keep my identity. But when you're up to 66%, you've become so dependent. You're in the same dependency situation you're supposed to be helping people out of. So I think we have to really rethink. And it's all right there. It's subsidiarity. I mean, we kind of invented this stuff. So now we have to reinvent it. So that's what's exciting. It's going to be fun. Thank you. Good to be with you.